Cup welcomes CBS News correspondents Edward R. Murrow, Daniel Shore, and Alexander Kendrick to join At Random next.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another session of At Random, a show dedicated to the lively art of conversation. Tonight, our At Random session is featured by the presence of a number of CBS's top correspondents, and we'll meet in just a few moments. We'd like to remind you once again that the opinions expressed by my guests are strictly their own. The show is unrehearsed. Now let's meet our distinguished panel this evening. First, this is Peter Kelleher, CBS News correspondent in Tokyo and the Far East. This is Daniel Shore, CBS News correspondent in West Germany and also an authority on Africa. This is Alexander Kendrick, a very distinguished gentleman from London, CBS News correspondent stationed in London and an authority on all European affairs. This, of course, is the dean himself, who needs no introduction, Edward R. Murrow, certainly one of the most distinguished personalities in broadcasting. And this is a gentleman we're glad to welcome to At Random, Dr. Robert M. Hutchins, the former president and chancellor of the University of Chicago, and the former president of the Ford Foundation. Now he is president of the Fund for the Republic and chairman of the board of editors of Encyclopedia Britannica. And this is Blair Clark, CBS News correspondent in New York. Now let's join the panel.
In numbers, it's impressive.
It certainly is to me.
Content is another.
Gentlemen, you have all been properly introduced, and without wasting any time, I'd like to toss out a question I think we're all concerned with, particularly in view of a headline I saw the other day urging Kennedy to tell the public the truth about our relations with Russia. I wonder if the field of communication, which we're all engaged, is doing the job it should do and can do in keeping our people informed. Dr. Hutchins, you're certainly involved in that problem, as all of us are.
No.
You want to pass it to Mr. Murrow?
Answer is no.
How could we do a better job, Ed?
What do you think?
I think there is something lacking someplace along the line. I think all of us, newspaper, radio, television, could do a more intense, a more deliberate job in fulfilling what we call our obligations?
Search me.
Yes and no.
Where yes and where no?
Well, Cop, I'd like to hear from some of the colleagues who haven't yet spoken on this point before I get going on that.
Peter, what do you think?
Nothing doing.
You're shaking your head as if you have no opinion or we're not doing the right job.
No opinion.
No opinion? Dan?
Tough one.
I say we're off to a rousing start.
Don't tell us this stopped you.
This is collusion, Cup. We decided to leave it to you.
We thought we
just wonder what would happen if nobody said anything.
It's a new kind of panel.
You know, Cup, I think the conclusion to this would be there may be something in what you say.
Seriously, though, Dr.
I'd like to start
Dr.
over,
Hutchins,
would you?
Yes, I'd like to put that question to you on a serious note.
What was your question?
What was that
again? Why is radio, television, and the press doing such a great job in keeping our public informed?
Why is it doing such a great job?
That's the reverse of what I said originally.
Mm. Well, it's an interesting way to state it.
You don't think it is?
I shouldn't have thought so. Perhaps I don't live in the right part of the country. Perhaps I never have. I used to live in Chicago. Now I live in Southern California. It's a little difficult for us out there to find out what's going on in the world.
But Ed, you've been around for a long time. I'm sure you have some opinions on the capabilities and how we're carrying them out.
Oh, the instrument is there, Cup. I don't think it's being used to its full potential. I think we in this country have developed an allergy to unpleasant news. We don't want to be told things that upset us or disturb us. And the mass media respect that desire on the part of the citizenry, I think. Don't you, Bob?
Oh, yeah.
It's part of it.
I also don't think we have really decided what we want to do, how we want to use the mass media. We use them primarily for entertainment. I think instruction comes secondarily. And also, the country is split. We are a political people. We have violent ideas about things, and we try to reach the lowest common denominator of agreement. And sometimes when you get down that low, you really don't have much.
The trouble with mass media is that they are mass media. And in an era of rising costs, and in an era where you're basing all your programming, and in a sense, all your newspaper writing and publishing on cost per thousand, instead of on trying to produce quality, you tend to sink to the point where you can reach the largest number of people instead of reaching them with the best you can do.
Well, it all depends what you're talking about. If you mean entertainment or if you mean news. Because I think that it's been shown pretty well that a good controversial news or public affairs program can reach a lot of people and can interest a lot of people. The point is that compared to an amusement feature, it doesn't draw the same audience. So the thing to do is to arbitrarily say so much is going to be for the mass media, for the news and public affairs program, come anything in high water. I almost said that word. And the other side, say, allot the others to entertainment.
Well, this is the same reason, presumably, why Mad Magazine or Playboy sells more copies than the Encyclopedia Britannica. Is that not true, Doctor?
I think it may sell a few more, but the remarkable thing is that we'll sell this year something like 30,000 sets of great books of the Western world. We'll sell 80,000 sets of Encyclopedia Britannica, and this is these are both very expensive items. The trouble seems to me to lie in this matter of distribution. It seems to me that when you say the American people prefer whiskey to schools, you are setting up a false dichotomy. You were saying because the American people spend more money on whiskey than they do on schools, therefore they prefer whiskey to education. But the point about whiskey is that you can get it. All you have to do is go down to the corner and there it is. How would you get a school? How would you buy a school? This requires an ability to manipulate and work through our established democratic institutions to the desired result. And it's this whole creaky institutional framework in which we live, which is illustrated magnificently by the state of the mass media. Here you've got the most marvelous instrument in the history of mankind. You can do anything. You can talk to anybody, anywhere. You can educate everybody, everywhere. And we use it for the purpose of diverting ourselves with what I would regard as low-grade entertainment. Now, the assumption is that this is what the people want. This is what I'm always told by your colleagues in the business. Well, we're giving the people what they want. But does this really follow? And isn't the remedy to try to develop cultural pay television, at least, that will enable the person who wants to buy education to buy it? Now, if you want to buy it through the mass media, you can't do it.
I wouldn't accept that as the basic problem. I think it's fine if you want to provide people with a way of choosing what they want through pay television in principle. But in Europe, we find that television on the whole, and for some reason we seem to have gotten down to television as the medium, in Europe you tend to find better programs than you find here, partly because you have semi-public bodies running it with a sense of responsibility for what ought to be put on. There is some attention paid to what the public wants, but not entirely to what the public wants. Public tastes have to be developed. Public has to be shown things which they may get to like after a while. You can't feed any child on a diet just of candy. The child may say it just wants candy, but all candy isn't necessarily good for a child. I think that in Britain, France, Germany, you find programming isn't so bad without paid television, although they do pay in the form of license fees for the use of their sets. I think what we seem to lack in the United States is an organ of public responsibility. We have an FCC which has no control over programs. We have no national body which seems to have a sense of, I won't use the word control, which is a bad semantic word, which has a national sense of what should be given to the public, what this medium should be used for.
Dan, I think you're treading on very dangerous ground, because I arrogate to nobody and to no group of people, the taste, the good taste, the political sense, or anything to be able to tell me what I ought to read or what I ought to see.
Yes, well, this is the great American anarchy. This is the road on which we will slide to hell, the word you didn't want to use before. This idea that because we have this God-given right to do anything we want to do, therefore that means that television networks can do what they want to do with us.
Well, now look, for instance, this is a story you've heard before, but not necessarily everybody else. Going into the Soviet Union, with 14 cases of camera equipment as a tourist, I was stopped by the customs man in the town of Tashkent, and there was only one item which he refused to pass at first, and that was a copy of that eminent Chicago publication Playboy, which we just mentioned.
Yes.
And he did it because in the Soviet Union, that sort of publication is contraband.
No, it isn't. It's just that the customs man didn't know it. They'd much have you bring in a copy of Playboy than a copy of Tom Paine, but not every customs official is well informed.
I want to ask you a question. Would you agree that one of the problems is how you take care of minorities and how you enlarge minorities? That is.
Yes, but BBC takes care of minorities by providing a third program.
Granted. So all I want to know is what, in your opinion, in our situation, would be the best, quickest, easiest way of taking care of minorities?
There's no best and quickest way, but I think the only really rational solution for it is to have a national body which, without censoring the content of programs, holds television and radio responsible for providing content which can be
a
satisfaction to
minorities.
This is
a utopian dream. Why not grab what I have offered you in the infinite generosity of my heart? Why not grab cultural pay television?
Because I have no confidence in it. Pay television will be competitive and will put on full-length feature movies, for a price you can see 10 years before. Can I interrupt for just a moment? Why will pay television
I have to
be
get
better?
A commercial in here, Dan. We'll come right back to this pay
now
television.
Now, there's your problem. Go ahead.
That is it. I want to stipulate that kind of pay television that I have in mind would not be used for, quote, commercial purposes. Define education and culture any way you like, but limit it to that, so that it offers to the minorities that I am sure will expand. We know they're there, and I'm sure they will expand if they have an opportunity.
Who would sponsor your kind of pay television?
I think that Harry Sherman has shown with the Book of the Month Club, and Bill Benton has shown with the Encyclopedia Britannica, that there is not only a very important educational contribution that can be made, but that it can be made on a sound financial basis.
Do you have any objection in principle to a subsidized cultural program?
I have no objection in principle to it. I'm suggesting that the way that I have proposed is the quickest, easiest, most effective way of meeting the problem that you're talking about.
Now, you see, there was a dispute a moment ago between Pete Kelleher and me. He wouldn't arrogate rights to anybody. And the question now seems to be whether rights are given to responsible elected bodies or bodies under the control of elected officials,
I agree with you. You understand? I think what you propose is just fine. I think it's extremely hard to get. And I'm suggesting that perhaps a way toward it is the one that I have proposed.
Why do you address yourself to this minority that is seeking for enlightenment and education? Wouldn't it be better and really more in line with the purposes of our mass media to try to raise the level of the majority? Wouldn't that be really the way to do it? In other words, the core of the problem lies right in the existing media. Let us do something to improve the media instead of setting up parallel media.
I agree with Alex.
Now, it seems to me that Ed Morrow made a speech right here in Chicago a little while back that bore on the problem of how commercial television can do it. And he's been so quiet until now that I'd like to have him explain the
utopian dream at the end of it.
Well, you would not expect me to recapitulate a speech that is more than 2 years old. I do remember beginning it by saying I thought it would do nobody any good.
That's how Lincoln began, too, Ed.
At least I was right. I don't know. The thing that troubles me about your proposal for pay television, Bob, is that essentially it's going to be box office.
Well,
And box office means reaching for the maximum number of customers that you can get through the turnstile.
Don't forget my stipulation. Don't forget my stipulation. My stipulation is that this is cultural pay television.
Well, now, what do you mean by cultural?
You're just going to frighten people away. Really, you are.
Cultural and pay are almost contradictory terms.
I don't think so. The third program doesn't frighten people away because it's the third program.
No, we have a completely different situation there. The BBC has a complete monopoly of radio communications in Britain. It has three programs. One is the home service. So-called.
Who are those other people, those advertising people with television?
That's
well,
television.
We're talking about radio.
Oh,
now.
I see. I beg your pardon.
BBC and radio, and the third program exists only on radio. There is now a proposal in Britain to have a third program in television. There's a competition for the possession of that program between the BBC and the commercial people. This thing will be resolved next year when the BBC Act comes up for reconsideration. I think there's a good chance that the third program in Britain will be given to the BBC rather than to the commercial people, simply as a result of what's happened during the past 3 years of the operations of the commercial networks, which, I may say, do not suffer from sponsorship, but suffer from something much worse. They suffer
from
sheer commercialism. These are people who have no business whatsoever in mass media. These are people who used to run theaters, movie houses, and they run their commercial television exactly the same way on the basis of putting out the cheapest kind of programs and getting the most advertising to go with those programs. This has been, in my mind, a failure, although for some time, perhaps 2 years, it attracted the majority of viewers in Britain. This trend has now changed. The trend now is back to the BBC. The BBC, I may say, has benefited by this commercial competition because it has jolted the BBC out of its old maiden aunt ideas of a few years ago, made it a much livelier organization, really has given it a competitive basis with commercial television, and BBC has beaten commercial television and will therefore carry the standards of enlightenment in Britain, I think.
May I make this parallel? There is in Japan today a network which was licensed entirely on the basis of being an education television, called Nippon Educational Television. The only way they could get a franchise was by calling themselves that. And they are bending over backwards, trying to figure out ways in which they can still bring in entertainment programs and qualify as a television network. I mean, as an educational network.
What do they provide in educational television in Japan?
Anything that could possibly be stretched under the word educational. In other words, if it's a quiz program,
These have been very educational in America.
Yes, well, of course, but the thing is that they have...
How about American Western movies with Japanese dubbing?
That they are not quite able to do, but they have a lot of American movies.
You mean the Easterns?
Yes, the Easterns, yes. They have a lot of American public affairs programs, which they put in, dub in Japanese, but they go beyond that. They go into entertainment programs, which really... don't quite come under education, but they say they do because they show the aspect of something that nobody knows about. But what they would like would be to shed the whole thing and go right out there for the mass market, but they daren't because their franchise won't let them.
Don't you think that in a lot of this talk about whether the networks do a good job, there's a tendency among the critics of television to say that anything that is informational in our area, news, public events, public affairs, is good, and anything that's nonfiction is bad. That they are always saying that more news, more public events, and so on and so forth, which seems to me to miss a distinction. You can do good public affairs, good news, or you can do it not so well, and sometimes we do a little of both. Now I think CBS does 15% public affairs, news, nonfiction, and 85% fiction, but I think the critics sometimes neglect criticism of the way we do news and nonfiction on television.
I'd like to ask Dr. Hutchins if any of the stuff we're discussing here comes under the study of the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, which you head out at Santa Barbara.
Yes, the Center studies the mass media and the other institutions that have developed in this country since the adoption of the Constitution, such as the corporation, the labor union, church-state relationship, which of course has entirely changed, the military foreign policy situation, which is entirely different than the one we had, and the political process. You remember, of course, that the political parties are not even contemplated by the Constitution. So the effort is to try to figure out whether democracy is possible in the contemporary world, and if so, under what conditions.
Have you come to any temporary conclusion, even?
I should say not. The method of work is to try to clarify the issues as a basis for an argument, more or less as we've been trying to clarify the issue about the mass media here. We haven't come to any conclusion, but two or three different lines of approach have been set forth, which if pursued might lead to rational debate and so ultimately to a practical conclusion.
Is there any light to be gathered from the parallel of newspapers and magazines for the electronic media? Is there precedent of any hopeful value?
It seems to me that the position of the newspapers in the last, since 1947, when the Commission on the Freedom of the Press reported, has grown steadily worse through no fault, I think, of the people who are in charge of these enterprises. It's simply the fact of rising costs.
Yes. It's part of the curse of this country, not only in communications, but farming and everything else, and that curse is bigness.
Ed,
this comes back to what you were saying earlier about the minorities, because we have fewer newspapers now than we had 5 years ago. We have more single newspaper towns.
That's right.
And most of the communication that is done electronically is superimposed on this country, either from New York or Hollywood. Regionalism is thereby suppressed.
I was horrified to find on a trip through the country where I visited several newspapers, something that happened while I was away in Europe in the past few years, which I'm sure every newspaper man knows about, which is automatic teletypesetting by the news agencies. I was in a newspaper in the state of Washington and watched the type being set from New York. Instead of getting your news over your AP printer, which could be edited, used with other news, the type was being set and it was going into the paper entirely out of control of the editor of that newspaper. Now, the idea of a man sitting at a keyboard in New York and, in fact, putting together newspapers all over the country, I found particularly frightening.
They're even putting one out in Europe that way. They have a teletype set up across the Atlantic Ocean, and a paper which is edited in New York is printed automatically in Paris.
There is an editor, though, Dan, someplace along the line.
It's yes,
edited.
But he steadily loses control. It was explained to me that the time factor and the cost factor is such that he would have to break up that type to make any changes in it.
Yes.
In type, and then he has to break up type to make a change, which is an inhibiting factor in changing
it. The editor's only job is to get letters of complaint from the readers. Uh-huh.
What about the old argument that people get what they deserve, which is one of the classic cynical remarks about government?
I think Shaw answered that when he said, "You must get what you want, or you will come to want what you get."
Blair, you
this
mentioned
is the danger
that CBS
in this whole system now.
Has 15% of its programs allotted to news and public affairs. Okay, now what's wrong with this blindingly simple thing? In order for a television network to have its franchise, it must devote 15, 16, 17%, according to the FCC, of its time to news and public affairs program, otherwise it cannot be licensed as a television network.
But it might be all discussion programs like this one.
Well, or it might be, but then it would have to compete with other news and public affairs programs, which will also have to devote 15 or 16 or 17% of their times of each network.
Well, so Pete, I think the question is the level of competition. I think the competition idea is a good idea. We should compete one network against another, yeah. But not in an attempt to get to a lower level, in an attempt to get to a higher level. That's our problem.
No, but you see, under the category news and public affairs, NBC, CBS, ABC, they have to devote a certain percentage or they're out of business.
Yeah. So we're talking about quality, you know, not quantity.
This is highly theoretical, you know.
Well, I say that, but suppose this were imposed. Then you would have a question of these various networks competing with each other on the quality and the ability to hold their audiences on the field of news and public affairs.
Well, in the first place, whatever you can impose on the networks will not necessarily be imposed on the stations, because thanks to our present system in which we do not monopolize stations, no network can force its product on the individual stations. To have something going out over the vacuum of a network and never ending up on stations would not help very much.
There is a much simpler solution to all this, it seems to me. Every licensee in his application for a license to operate makes certain promises drawn up by very expensive counsel. He submits outlines of programs. He makes a commitment. Most of them welch on the commitment. And it ought to be possible to measure performance against promise.
Ideally, I think this ought to be done by a broadly based group of local citizens who would hail them into the court of public opinion when they violate the promises they've made.
That's another question
I'd like to ask. Well, in effect, that's holding them to a contract.
Do you believe that a continuing agency for the appraisal of the media, which would, in effect, be the court of public opinion or the representative of the court of public opinion, would be effective in raising the standards of the mass media?
I certainly do. I think content ought to be audited, so to speak, just as books are audited. A very difficult thing to do.
Post-audited,
that's right.
I'd like to get back to the center for just a moment, Dr. Hutchins. Do you do any specific studies on referring to coverage, let's say, of the Cuban situation, the coverage of the Congo situation?
No, we've done very few spot studies of that kind. We're not equipped for that. Most of our work is of a somewhat longer term.
As a newspaperman, I'm very concerned about the kind of coverage we got out of Cuba and getting out of the Congo, whether our public is really informed about what is the real situation there. And I'm afraid many of us are due for a rude awakening when the story is written, perhaps by historians.
This is my opinion.
Don't you think, though, let's take the case of Cuba, if that isn't getting off the track. It seems to me the essential background fact about Castro was that we were running into a situation where the fact that we owned something like 75% of the electrical industry of Cuba and a lot of the traction and public transportation thing, we were running into a situation where that was bound to be attacked by reformers, revolutionaries, or whatever. That fact was reported in various ways. It may not have been called attention to in a dramatic way, as we would have liked to have seen it in the mass media, but it was lying around for any of us to know. Along comes Castro. I say we don't have as much right to be surprised as a lot of us pretend. It was a potentially bad situation. The facts are there. I don't know how you present them so people are aware of them. I think it took our own government, for example, by surprise.
Let's pause here for just a moment for one more commercial.
Cup, we really
got to
go.
Cup, I've got to leave you.
Yeah. Next commercial will break in 10 minutes. We're back on the air. Ed, when you conducted this symposium with these gentlemen over the CBS network, Smith made a great point about education, more education, more education. I wonder, Dr. Hutchins, if the educational institutions of our country are living up to the standards you, for one, would uphold.
Oh, dear.
What do you think? Let me put a specific question to him. You abolished football at the University of Chicago. How do you stand on touch football?
I'm for it.
I've
always been in favor of exercise for other people.
You'll notice that in the last couple of days, Denver University and Marquette both have abolished
something like 10 institutions since the end of the season, yes.
But let's get back to the job the education institutions are doing.
Well, the educational institutions, it seems to me, are gradually becoming places of accommodation. They're places where young people go until we're ready to have them go to work. It may be that the tremendous pressure that has now been put on the institutions of higher learning and is going to remain on them for some years will for the first time give them the feeling that they can now exact some A, high admission standards, B, some hard work. But the whole history of education in the last 30 years can be described by saying that it has been the gradual replacement of freshman and sophomore work by high school work, so that most of the freshman and sophomore work at a big university, a big state university today, is work that 50 years ago would have been done in high school. This is a steady process of dilapidation of educational standards, educational requirements, a steady blurring of all educational aims, with the result that you have big institutions containing a lot of people, but nothing proportionate to the effort or money that goes into it coming out.
Why do we continue to use the term education? This is now a debased currency.
I think housing would be probably just as good a term.
Entertainment, too?
Housing and
how do you account for that? I don't mean to equate economics with the education we get, but we spend more per capita for education than any country in the world.
Well, you can spend money on anything. You don't just because you call it education, it doesn't mean that you're going to get education. If you were to have a college, for example, exclusively devoted to tap dancing, the manufacture of ice cream cones, home economics, and similar subjects, it might be very expensive, but the education wouldn't be any good.
There are some like that, aren't there?
Yes, there are a good many.
Well, Doctor, do you think that America actually has got the capacity for a mass education on the level that you would like it?
Yes, you see, I don't believe the British slogan, which is that if you set out to educate everybody, you'll end up by educating nobody. Mm. I do not think that that is a necessary, that is a sequitur. I think it's a non sequitur. It's extremely difficult to do, and you must limit yourself. You must know what you're trying to do at all times, and you must limit yourself to those objects. But given the capacity of the American educational system, using capacity in every sense of the word, if it could bring itself to define an educational purpose that was intelligible, I believe that it could perform the educational task and perform it for everybody. I think that the doctrine of education for everybody is the greatest contribution that America has made to the theory and practice of democracy.
Would you temper that at all with an elite system?
No, I wouldn't at all.
I'd like to put the question to you a little bit differently. In a couple of years in Russia, the one thing that struck me, of many things that struck me about Soviet education and its difference from American, and the zeal of Russians to get university education and to work hard at it, was that education in Russia seems to confer status and economic opportunity,
this
but especially
true.
Status. Here I find that decreasingly does education mean status, which seems to reduce
right.
the incentive for it.
Mm-hmm.
How can we make it so in this country that it is a great thing to be educated, that it opens up opportunities, makes you feel proud to have a degree and to be educated?
I think that's happening already.
The statement is quite correct. The Platonic line is the great line on the subject. That what is honored in a country will be cultivated there. And if you set up, let's say, you're getting as rich as Croesus or Rockefeller, as what's honored in a country, that's what will be cultivated. Well, it just happens, as the case of many of our financial heroes shows, but there is no relation between education and financial success.
Sometimes inverse.
And maybe inverse, as Henry Ford, Rockefeller, and Thomas Edison all condemned education as a handicap to success in life. And, Horatio Alger was a notoriously badly educated young man.
I should be the richest man among you.
And probably are.
Probably are.
So, is there an answer to this? Is there something that can be
yes.
done about it?
If the... No, it's a very simple matter. If the president of everybody in authority in this country, from the president of the United States down, showed that in his opinion the intellectual development of our people was its primary necessity.
Well, he's made it a primary necessity to get educated at Harvard.
Yes, I think he's lifted education.
What's wrong with that?
You're speaking of the president elect.
Yes.
I'm talking about the president. I would say that the president of the United States had indicated that the most important thing in life was golf. And as long as you have that situation, you can expect to have golf cultivated far more assiduously than the intellectual virtues.
Bob, this is
not
only because you're against
golf.
Exercise. You once said that when you felt the urge to exercise, you just lay down until
it
went away.
This doesn't take long.
Well, I'm concerned, like I'm sure the other boys are. What is the answer to this? How do we rectify this situation? What can we, telling the public that's viewing this show?
No, what can you do about it is a difficult question. But the first thing you have to do is to take education seriously, which is really the implication of your remark. They take it seriously in Russia because they have to. Maybe they have some other reasons, too. But certainly the only way you can get ahead in Russia is to be educated. Well, this may or may not get you ahead in the United States. It may turn out to be a sheer waste of time from the standpoint of getting ahead. Might have been better to go and work on the railroad or some other
climate. The reason it's that way in Russia is because they feel that national survival is necessary to have a great majority
right.
of the people educated.
Well, why isn't it perfectly
well,
obvious?
Well, I think that this is gradually happening here.
What I was going to say. Why isn't it perfectly obvious in the United States that this country, unless it develops to the maximum,
yeah.
its intellectual power, isn't going to survive either.
Well, I think you're both wrong in thinking it's a matter of national survival. I think you're stating it in utopian terms. I think there's a twofold reason for the difference. One is that Europe, even before communism invaded Europe, has had a tradition of statists coming through education before we had it. And secondly, in Russia particularly, since they have abolished capitalism and abolished any easy way to make millions commercially, except for some black marketers, the only way to get ahead is to achieve status through education.
Why start with Europe? Why don't you go back to China? After all, the Mandarin class, the educated class, the civil servants were the ones who, by national examinations, became acquired status, simply through education and proficiency in that field.
There are very few things that people, as people, do for national survival. That's a big concept for the average person to accept.
This is true, but the reason why the Russian, everything in Russia is directed toward honoring education may be national survival.
But it just starts differently.
The same is true here. The reason why we ought to direct all our attention to honoring education, real education, is that our not our national survival, but certainly our national development depends on it.
And our national survival.
Who cares about our national development?
I do.
I mean, aside from us and only when we're on television, but who really cares about our national development?
If you don't care about national development or national survival, then you care about your own individual survival and your own individual development. And presumably this also involves something more than learning how to earn a living.
Aren't we more concerned with gross national product than we are with national development?
Yes, we are, but I think this is a mistake.
Of course it's a mistake.
As we've seen in the last debates.
I'd like to... Go ahead, Peter, I'm sorry.
Well, no, I just wanted to bring our attention to the time.
Yes, yeah. Just one more question I thought we'd get to.
I'd like to add one thing to this topic.
Sure.
I have the feeling that perhaps the development of education in Russia is our best hope of survival.
That's a good point.
Because I do not believe it possible to train half a man's mind in the physical sciences, for example, because the curiosity...
That's
must
true.
Then expand, and they will have an appetite to pursue the truth wherever it leads them, and this may have built-in dangers for the Russian regime.
I'd like to associate myself with Dr. Morrow's remark.
Thank you, Doctor.
The question of national survival, just one more point here, brings up the admission of Red China, which is on the verge of becoming a member of
how does
the
that bring
United
it up?
Nations.
Hmm? How does that bring it up?
National survival, it's pretty closely related, I'd say. Ed, what do you feel that the U.S. attitude should be toward a Red China that eventually will become a member of the United Nations?
Well, I think at the outset it should be one of very quiet exploration, probably in Warsaw. I think we must recognize the fact that Chiang Kai-shek does not represent 650 million Chinese on the mainland. I think this is a matter for quiet negotiation.
It'll be a shock, there's no question about it, to us, because we don't like the way they came to power and so on, but it's probably a fact.
Well, we're going to pause for a commercial, but before we do, I want to say goodbye to you gentlemen. Thank you, Dr. Hutchins.
We really do have to catch it.
Happy birthday.
We have to go.
Fine.
Thanks,
thank you, Ed. Right. Nice to be with you.
Sometimes foreign correspondence, Cup.
Thank you. Bye, Peter. Thank you so much.